This is Lance and Fisher Body Historical Team. Today is May 3rd, 2006. It's approximately 9:15 a.m. We're at the UAW Local 602 Frank Dreyer Greenhouse. First, we'll introduce the team.
John Fedewa.
Jerry Smith.
And I'm Cheryl McQuaid. Today, we're interviewing David Brown. David, will you state your name and spell it for us, please?
David Brown, D-A-V-I-D-B-R-O-W-N.
And your address?
524 North Deerfield, Lansing, Michigan, 48917.
Are you married? Do you have children?
I'm married. I have a blended family. My wife has two sons and I have a daughter, but they're all our kids.
Where were you born and raised?
I was actually born in Battle Creek because at the time there was no Protestant hospitals in Kalamazoo. Kalamazoo is where I lived, and I was raised in Kalamazoo, but had to go to Battle Creek to go to a Protestant hospital to be born, so kind of an unusual story for the time. So,
what did your parents do?
My dad worked for the paper company in Kalamazoo, and my mother was a housewife.
Could you tell us what your educational level is?
I'm currently working on my second master's degree in public administration, and I've previously had a bachelor's degree in education and a master's degree in education.
Were you in the military?
No, I was not.
Did GM help you with any of your educational achievements?
Oh, yes. I had my bachelor's degree, and it was probably about halfway through my master's degree when I hired into General Motors, but I finished up my master's degree through the tuition assistance program. And in fact, I took an educational leave in order to do that because I was starting to lose more credits than what I had on my record. So I took off one term to finish my master's degree and used tuition assistance to do that. And I'm currently using tuition assistance to work on my master's degree in public administration.
When did you hire into Fisher Body? Do you know what your seniority date is?
March 21st, 1977. Show you my date there.
Why did you hire into Fisher Body?
Well, I was married. I had a little baby, and I was trying to get into the field of education. That's where I'd gotten my degree. And at the time, there was hiring for teachers. In fact, I had actually worked for the school district for the superintendent on a couple of different projects. Worked for the reentry program, and I worked for the Model Cities program. And developed those educational programs for the city, but it was principals that hired, not the superintendents. And I did not have the connections to get into the schools, and they were hiring very few, if any, people at all. So it was almost impossible for me to get a job teaching. I was working in the reentry program in Lansing as a teacher's aide, but wasn't making the kind of money that I needed to support family. And my next-door neighbor worked for Fisher Body at the time and said, well, Dave, why don't you go down and apply? And so I did that. In fact, when I applied, I went down and found out that I had a hernia, which I did not know I had when I went through medical. And they told me, go and get your hernia fixed and then come back and we'll hire you. And that's what I did. So I actually came in 76 when the huge group of people came in, but at that time I had that injury, so they wouldn't hire me.
Do you remember, what was the application process like? Was long lines?
When I came in, no, there was not. Like I say, I came in sort of an off time in 77. There was a huge hiring group in 76 and another one in 78. But when I came in, there was probably only about 30 people a month that were coming through. So I didn't have to stand in line and wait like a lot of other people did who hired in this place.
Do you remember your first day?
I remember my first night probably more than my first day. I went home at night, went to sleep, and I dreamed about cars coming down the assembly line. So that was really a weird experience for me. But I was painting cars, and that's what I dreamed all night long, was the cars coming at me. So
you hired into the paint department?
Yes, I did. I was spraying grounded Duco.
How did you find the paint department?
How did I find it? You mean...
Were you escorted to paint?
Oh, yes, yes. I had somebody pick me up at personnel and walk me out to the paint department, which wasn't very far because paint department at that time was right next to the personnel area. It was downstairs currently where the trim department has been located for the last few years.
Do any of your other family members work at Fisher Body?
No, I'm the first generation. My My wife used to work here. That's how I met my current wife, Joyce. She was working in the shop, but I didn't have. I'm not like a second or third generation employee. So
you were spray painting cars. What kind of training was involved in spray painting?
I broke in with somebody on the day shift, and they put me on day shift for 30 days to train me. And basically, it was the old 3-day kind of rule that they believed in at that time. Somebody worked with you, sort of the mentor, and helped you and showed you how to spray. And after 3 days, they put the gun in your hand and says, you do the job. And the expectation was that you could perform the job at that time.
And could you?
I think so. I did fairly well, so.
What did
occasionally
you
somebody would come back and tell me there was a sag in a wheel well or something, but, I think it did a fairly good job.
What did you think of the paint department?
It was kind of scary, probably why I had nightmares. I mean, it was old and dirty, and it was probably one of the older buildings in the plant at that time, because that was before they had the new paint department. The booths were all enclosed. The offices were the old traditional green rooms where everything was painted green, sort of the military type of green, and it was not clean. There was they had the cinder block type floors and asphalt over the top of it, and had holes every once in a while in the floor. So it wasn't what you would consider a pristine environment, but I didn't expect to have a clean spot where I came to work.
What did you think of the people around you?
Oh, I love the people I worked with. A lot of different variations in people, a lot of different characteristics. But people welcomed you and they tried to accommodate you and work with you and help you. There were sometimes a few pranksters or a few jokers that you had to deal with, but outside of that, I love the folks.
What kind of jokes and pranks?
Well, I hired in March, and I got the typical, go to the gate for your Christmas turkey thing, but I wasn't foolish enough to believe that. But there was a few folks that I worked with that came in about the same time that actually went down to get their Thanksgiving turkey, so. But I figured it was a prank, so I sort of stood back and watched other people see what they did.
So you were on the day shift for 30 days, and then you went to the second shift. Did you go to that shift to the same job, different job?
I broke in on the third door jams is what I did, and actually when it came to nice, I did the first door jams. Third door jam was considered to be a premium job. It was more the touch-up and that type of thing. And first door jam is where they got the initial coats of paint on, and that's what I did.
What did you think the difference was going to the second shift? Was there a big difference?
Actually, I like second shift better because I didn't like getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and coming to work, so. Probably there was a little bit more laid-back atmosphere, too. There wasn't as many salary personnel on the second shift as there were on first, so there wasn't as much pressure on supervisors to get things done as there was on day shift.
What did you think of the supervisors?
I had mixed reactions. I had some supervisors that I really liked, and some of them that I thought were absolutely worthless. Probably the person that I disliked the most is the one who did me the best favor, and that was Keith Ward, because I was scheduled to come in to spray the undercoats of the cars, which was really a dirty and messy job. And when Keith found out that I'd had a degree, he said that was no job for me, and he ended up putting me in the spray booth. But Keith was a very sneaky guy. He would stand behind posts and watch people to see whether or not they were going to mess up and, aha, I caught you type of thing. And I didn't like that. I thought that lacked total integrity. If anybody had a concern with my work or the quality of my work or the amount of work I did, all they had to do was talk to me. They didn't have to sneak up and try to catch me doing something wrong. So I didn't like that kind of mentality, but I also had supervisors that would nurture you and talk to you and try to encourage you, and if you didn't do something right, have somebody come in and show you how to do it or tell you how to do it themselves. So there was a mixed bag of people that were in supervision.
Did you view your coworkers as brothers and sisters?
Well, I kind of viewed them as family. I mean, I depended on them, and they depended on me, so you developed a strong relationship with the people you worked with.
Can you tell us what a typical day was like in the plant?
Well, you did the same job over and over and over and over and over again all day long. So, I mean, that was difficult at the time. It was enjoyable having breaks with certain people because we had rotating breaks at the time, and you'd be off at various times with people from different departments, and you'd have an opportunity to meet new people. So that became enjoyable, as finding out people that you didn't really work with every day, but were scattered around the area where you worked, and have an opportunity to meet them and get to know more about them. But the work was fairly repetitive. And probably the thing I disliked the most is if you saw something wrong or wanted to give suggestions, you had no ability to do that. I remember when I first hired in fact, I was loaned out that day, and I was on the wet deck. And this is probably one of the, still on day shift, and I saw that there was a problem, and the line went down, and I knew what the problem was. And I approached one of the supervisors, because at that time when the line broke down, all of a sudden it was like dozens of people in white shirts would come and approach the problem area. And I stopped one of those people, and I knew what it was, and said, I think I know what the problem is. And the guy told me to sit down and shut up. If he wanted anything from me, he'd ask me. And so I sat there and watched while they spent the next 15 minutes figuring out what I knew was wrong. And just kind of laughed to myself. And, you know, it created a bad attitude in me. And I think there were a lot of other employees who had the same kind of attitudes because, you know, they had input in ways that they knew they could make the process better and yet had no opportunity to do that.
Being spray painting cars, you were in a booth?
Yes, I was.
Could you try to explain the environment of working in a booth?
It's metal walls on both sides of you and above you, and there were hoses that were hanging up on the walls. And we, at that time, probably had about 13 or 14 colors. At one point in time, we actually had to have two guns, so you had to exchange guns on hoses. And so you'd have to pull a gun off one hose and put it on another, clear the paint out, and then apply the paint on the job, and then end up doing the same thing over and over and over again. Every time a different color came down the line, you'd have to switch hoses and hang up the old hose, get down a new hose, and attach the gun and spray the car and do that repetition.
So if there were 13 colors, were there 13 hoses?
Yes.
And did you have any protective equipment to wear?
Oh yeah, we had to wear. Well,
had to or chose to.
I'm trying to think of what we had to wear. Safety glasses were probably the only requirement that I could think of right now that you had to wear. I mean, they gave you hearing protection, but you know, a lot of folks did not wear hearing protection. They chose not to do that. And I think safety glasses were probably the only thing we had to wear.
Jerry Smith.
Did you ever spray the wrong color on the car?
Accidentally or deliberately?
Either or.
Probably more deliberately than accidentally. In fact, talking about pranks, I was guilty of pranks. We had a guy that worked down the line. I won't mention his name. But he did not read the manifest. You know, we used to... Actually, we had a number that we wrote on the car, you know, 19 for black or whatever it might have been. And instead of reading the number, he would look at the color that we applied. So we deliberately applied the wrong color on the hinge, and then he would put that color on the side machine. I mean, I think about it now, and that's a terrible thing to do for the quality of the customer, but it was funny to see somebody do that and then all of a sudden panic and say, hey, why are you doing that? That's a black car, not a white car. But those are the kind of pranks that you played on each other. And I think the environment had a lot to do with that because you're, like I say, you're like in a little cell. You know, it was an iron booth that you had to spend all day in. So you got wild and crazy in there. So
were there any repercussions from that?
If we got caught, there would have been repercussions, but usually you didn't get caught. You got two more side machines that covered up the mistake, so...
And what kind of protective equipment did you wear in the booth? What did you feel they should have had people wear?
Well, I mean, now they wear coveralls and they wear hearing protection. I've got some hearing loss, and I think a lot of that's due to the fact that I didn't wear any hearing protection.
So it is loud in the booth.
Yeah, very loud. I mean, outside the booth it's like 85 decibels, but inside the booth it's probably over 100 decibels, so far exceeding what it should be for wearing hearing protection.
So was it easy to talk to? Did you have a partner? Or?
Well, we screamed across the line, yeah, but, you know, people constantly talked in the booth. But you had to shout in order to get anybody to hear you, because it was that noisy.
How did you pass the time?
In the booth or outside the booth?
Both.
You know? We did some pranks inside the booth to make things get a little more levity. And in fact, there was a guy, Ron, that worked down the line from us that used to think it was funny to take his air off the hose and then it would squirt just pure paint. And he'd, you know, get our pant legs or our boots and put a little paint on them. He would do that with a guy across the line from me, do the guy across from him. One day, Ron wore in a pair of painter pants, white painter pants. Big mistake. We all decided that was the day to get even with Ron. And so we squirted him, and all day long, up and down, every time he turned around, you know, more paint. He looked like a rainbow when he left that place for those brand new white painter pants. So we got some retribution. But you had to do things to keep you from going stir crazy, because, you know, doing the same job all day long just kind of made people nuts.
So being in the booth, you weren't able to read, listen to the radio?
Oh, no. I mean, there was no place to plug a radio in because you were dealing with naphtha thinners, and a spark would set the paint department on fire, so you couldn't have any kind of device that would have a spark associated with it. Even a battery radio you couldn't have. So, and you could probably read if you could find some place to put a book, and if you wanted to have the book destroyed, but it wasn't that people told you you couldn't read, it was just no place in that environment for it.
What did you do for lunch?
Well, I brought my lunch in every day, and probably the first year or so just sat around and talked. That's right, I'd been there for a year or two. There was a group of us that played euchre every time at lunch, and it was amazing how many hands of euchre you could play in lunch. In fact, I would go outside and play with friends outside, play euchre, and I would be absolutely nuts playing with them because they'd want to play every trick in the hand. You know, when you got good at playing, you know when you had your point, didn't have your point, you throw your hand in. And I mean, well, you can't throw your hand in. You know, we don't know how many tricks you got. Well, yeah, I've got this, and I got, because you got to the point where you knew exactly every card that was played, and you could play five or six different rounds of euchre in a 30-minute time frame. It was amazing how quickly you could play. But that's what we did for entertainment at lunchtime, while we were eating our lunch.
How about breaks? Did you have the wagon?
Yeah, that was a long time ago. I wasn't much of a wagon fan, so I usually brought in whatever I wanted in my lunch bucket and didn't use the wagon.
But did you enjoy the break?
Yeah, I enjoyed the breaks. But I did more conversation breaks. I didn't try to play cards or read or anything else during breaks. It was conversation and breaks. Getting to know more about my fellow workers.
What did you find out about your fellow workers? What kind of people did you work around?
Well, I worked around every kind of people. I found there was a lot of people who were as educated or more educated than I was. There were a lot of people who had hobbies on the outside, rebuilding cars. A lot of people had interest in hunting and fishing. A lot of people who had interest in arts and crafts. I mean, everybody had something that was made them special and unique. And it's one of the things that I really enjoyed about the people, but then I didn't see the application at work, because at work there was, you would see all this individuality of people, you would see all this creativity, and they never got the opportunity to express that while they were in their workplace. And I thought that was a shame, because there were people who were civic leaders and people who coached their kids' soccer teams and did all sorts of creative and innovative things, but when they came to work, all they did was the same thing day in and day out.
Were you ever a part of any of the department dinners?
I can't remember that many dinners that we were part of. I don't think they were as prevalent when I was working the line as they are now. It had to be a significant event in order to have a departmental dinner. If somebody passed away or something else where you'd have a dinner and then some kind of a fundraiser associated with that. But
did you ever have a coworker impact your family life?
Well, besides my two wives, I actually married two of the women that I worked with in the shop, so they definitely had an impact on my life.
So a romance in the shop, what was that like?
Oh, it was a painting place in Fisher Body. There were a lot of folks that I knew that were, you know, couples in the shop that were both married on the outside, had their own spouses on the outside, but they were sort of the shop husband and wife, and had toured affairs and all that kind of wonderful things that was going on in the shop. So I didn't do that, but I saw a lot of that, so.
Was it hard being married to somebody that your coworkers knew, or?
Well, it was interesting because I told you I'd married two of them, and I was married to one woman. I ended up divorcing her, and I was divorced for about 2 years before I started dating somebody else. And everybody in the shop ran up to her and said, "Don't hang out with Dave. He's married. Didn't you know he's married?" And she said, "No, he's divorced." "Oh no, he's married. He's married." Because I didn't try to make my life, you know, public knowledge in the shop, so people didn't know that I had gotten a divorce because I kept that to myself, and so everybody thought I was still married and thought I was cheating on my wife and thought that I was setting this young lady up. So
what is one of your best memories of Fisher Body?
I don't know that I have a best memory. I mean, I enjoyed every day I came to work. I tried to make the best of everything. I mean, that was sort of my mentality. And you're talking about Fisher Body, you're talking about the old shop, and I still have that, you know, concept today with where I'm at and what I'm doing today. I mean, to me, every day was an opportunity to do something different and unique and special. Obviously, when I went on as a district representative for the union, that was a significant time in my life, and I really enjoyed doing that. At the same time, you know, a lot of responsibility came with that. I used to party with folks after work and found it more and more difficult to go to a party and enjoy people's companies because all of a sudden I was no longer the guy that they party with. I was the district committee person, and I had to answer all the union questions instead of, you know, sitting back, relaxing, enjoying my time off work. So that was both probably one of the best times there and one of the worst times because, you know, it added a lot more responsibility to my life.
So how long did you work in the paint department?
I worked from 77 until 81, and 81 I became the district committee person.
For the paint department?
For the paint department on the second shift.
What was that whole process like?
The process of being a district committee person, or?
The process of getting the position and then being that person.
Well, I'll give you a funny story that goes with that. I had told people for a long time, because I played the check pool, if I ever win this check pool, I'm going to throw a party. Well, I won a check pool, and it was a huge check pool. And so I invited the entire paint department over to my place for a party. Well, this happened to be about 2 weeks before the election for district committee. I'd already signed up, but everybody accused me of trying to buy the election by getting everybody drunk. So whether that worked or not, I don't know. But that's what happened. I actually ran for the position. There was a couple other people running, and you know, pretty much in every kind of election you see, the votes were like half and half. So, and I won probably by about 10 or 15 votes or something for that first election.
You mentioned check pools. Could you explain what a check pool is?
At the time, and everybody played the check pool differently. So, but in the paint department, there were numbers. There was a series of numbers that were on everybody's check, and what you did is you played those numbers. So, if your numbers was 6123888, then you'd had four eights. You'd play like a poker hand. So you played the best five numbers that you had. So you could have five aces, and or you could have four eights or a full house or something else by having three of one number and two of another number. So you played it like you would play a poker hand, and whoever had the best hand won the check pool.
And how was that done?
Somebody would come all around with a, and ask you if you wanted to play the check pool, and they would take down your name, and then that when you got your checks on Friday, supervisors, or actually Thursday night on the night shift, they'd hand out your checks, and the guy who was doing running the check pool would come around and find out what numbers you had, and he'd look at your check and verify the numbers, and whoever had the best hand won the check pool.
When you became the district committee man, was that your first introduction into the union, or...
Actually, I had tried to run for a union election before that. I tried to run for a guide, and I had lost. It was funny because I watched what other people did, and people would put their name in their department and their seniority. Well, I did the same thing, but I put 2 years as seniority, and I got laughed right out of the work center because I had put my seniority date down there, because nobody would have voted for anybody with 2 years of seniority. That was their thought on that. I ran against Baker, in fact, who later became a district committee person on the day shift. So at one time we worked opposite of each other, but that was the first election I ran for and lost that election. And then learned how to more appropriately run for an election. So
by buying the vote.
And I that may have worked, it may not have worked, but I definitely didn't put my seniority on my cards when I passed out my cards running for office. So.
And what was it like being a committee person? Did you enjoy that job?
Well, I enjoyed it very much. The only problem was that, the situation I talked about is that I probably took that way more serious than what I should have for my own personal mental health. Other people would notice that come to work with me, that as I got closer to work, the veins in my neck would start popping out because I start thinking about all the things I needed to do that day as soon as I got in there. And at lunchtime and after work, there was always somebody who wanted my time and attention. So it was very demanding on your time and your personal life and everything else. But the rewards were wonderful. I mean, there had been people that I know who had been discharged if it hadn't been for what I did in interviews. There would have been people who would have lost money or who would have lost opportunities for advancement if I hadn't found the salary organization would make mistakes. So knowing that I was righting some wrongs that were happening was very rewarding. It had a very positive intrinsic reward for me.
Being a district committee man in the paint department, what was a typical committee call? Why did people call you?
Well, there's really wasn't typical. There's probably some different groups of calls that you had. Probably the first group of complaints that would be categorized under missed opportunities for advancement. There were a lot of people who would put in transfers for positions, and you would find out that the wrong person was placed on the job. In fact, it was probably one of the first problems that I had actually with my union brothers and sisters, because the mentality with the committee at that time was let management put somebody on and then write grievances against them for putting the wrong person on the job. And I just thought that was absolutely ridiculous, because you'd have somebody who'd be placed on the job and they would be upset because they'd be removed from the job, and the guy that should have been placed on the job, you know, a week or 2 weeks ago, was upset because he should have had that job 2 weeks ago instead of waiting for 2 weeks to get some kind of justice, if it was done in that short a period of time. And one of my first confrontations with the union was over that issue, and I said basically that I'm going to start looking at all the transfers and make sure the right person's put on. And in fact, today we have a person who does that full time. That's their job, is making sure that the right transfers are placed on. But at the time, it was heresy with the union to actually do the work of management, make sure the right person was placed on the job. Probably the second biggest group that I had was disciplinary issues. And when I went on committee, it was not unusual for me to spend probably an hour or 2 hours every night in an office with disciplinary interviews. And three, four, five people would run through a night for disciplinary interviews. And there were nights that I actually spent 8 solid hours doing nothing but holding interviews and couldn't even get a committee call because there was interviews lined up one after the other. And people were being disciplined for stupid things. Probably the worst case that I had was we had a guy that was up for discharge because he had had a coffee pot in his area, and it was an illegal coffee pot. The supervisor who took him down the office to discharge him for that was there the night before. I had witnessed him drinking coffee out of that same coffee pot. So he knew it was there. And that was when we first started Quality Work Life, and I actually went to Today Shift to Al Vandervoort. I think that's what his name was. I ended up going to with the QWL rep and myself, and one of the Today Shift committee men went to Al and talked to Al about the situation. And I said, I tried to get this thing resolved the night before, and every time I brought up the fact that the managers knew this coffee pot was there and the managers were drinking out of this coffee pot, so that, you know, this should not have been an issue that they disciplined anybody for, their response was, management's not on trial here. And I'm going, well, this is absurd. We say that hourly workers are going to have an equal voice in the organization. They're going to be equal partners with Quality Work Life. And then you turn around and you discipline somebody for doing the exact same thing that a manager is doing in the plant. So it's obvious there's no equity and there's no, you know, whatever else. And that was probably my most unique grievance experience because I'd actually written a couple of grievances on that as a consequence of that because they were trying to discharge him and they were giving another guy 30 days for it. And the supervisor who had drank out of the coffee pot and had wrote this discipline up was determined he wasn't going to undo the discipline. And Al had a lot more influence than he did, talked to the night shift superintendent and told him that he wanted those two grievances pulled. We got into the office with Keith Ward, and Keith said, I'm not going to pull those grievances. They're gone. They're out of here. And it ended up being a situation where he said, you need to do this. I'm going to have to give you a direct order if you don't. He made the superintendent give him a direct order to pull those grievances. And then it was just as nasty as can be about doing it. But I'll tell you, from that point on, my grievance load and discipline started going down and down and down because they didn't want to have this experience of having direct orders to pull grievances that they should have never had in the first place. But that was the kind of the mentality. I mean, the whole purpose behind the grievance procedure, discipline procedure, is to, and it's not even a discipline procedure, it's a corrective action procedure. It's to correct people's behavior. And the managers were not approaching this as corrective action. They were approaching this as discipline. They wanted to punish somebody that they thought was doing something wrong. And that kind of mentality had to stop. So we put a lot of pressure on to undo the behavior of management and to reduce that kind of workload. By the time I ended up going off of committee onto my next position, we were probably down to one discipline a month or two disciplines a month, as opposed to having three or four a day. But that was a huge part of my daily work, was doing discipline. It was probably actually more time commitment than it was for the other. The third group was issues that I had as a committee person were probably just general things that people were unhappy about. Water fault didn't work, or a floor was slippery, or some of them might have been safety issues, but there were a lot of little things that people were upset about. People being told they couldn't go out of their department and all those kind of things, so... It was just sort of a general miscellaneous category.
We interviewed a gentleman that was a district committee man in the 50s, I'd say. And he was like a part-time committee man. Did you do this full-time or...?
Yes, I was a full-time committee person. That was my job under the contract, is to be the representative for the paint department. And I was district for one term, which was 3 years, and... Started my second term before I went to a different position.
And what position did you go to next?
I became the training coordinator for Fisher Body, for Local 602. It was before actually training coordinators were a part of the contract. Both our plant and Local 652 had put on full-time training coordinators. And that stemmed out of the experience we had where we were retraining our workforce to build the new Grand Am in 1984. And they had a massive training program, which has been labeled Main Street School by our employees because it was in a building on Main Street. And we had some discipline problems over there, and I was the committee man. I was also the education chair for the local union, and that's why they called me over to be the principal at Main Street School to handle any kind of discipline problems or academic problems or whatever that we might have at the school.
And is that about the time that Fisher Body was no longer Fisher Body? It became BOP, BOC?
BOC, you know, I can't remember when all those changes were. We changed titles many times in my career over at Fisher Body, so I can't remember exactly when those changes were, but I would say that was probably when it was, because we were building the Grand Am, and that was Buick, so we were the Buick Oldsmobile Cadillac group at that time. So
could you tell us a little bit about Main Street School?
Well, Main Street School was basically just a collection of different people who had disciplines they wanted to share with people, suggestions, quality work life. We had our employee assistance program, and they also talked a little bit about the manufacturing processes, some new things that they were expecting to do with this new vehicle that they were producing. I did some little bit of problem solving, those type of things. It was just a series of classes. I think it was a 40-hour program that they had actually put on, and all of the employees had to go through this 40 hours of training.
And how many employees at that time?
There were probably 3,000 employees at that time.
And where did you go from there?
Position-wise?
Yes.
I became the first joint activities representative for the plant. And that's kind of interesting because we had a problem with training in many of the other disciplines. The UAW started becoming more joint with the corporation. We had, like I said, quality of work life. We had health and safety. We had apprentice programs. We had some quality initiatives we were working on. There was a number of programs that we were working on, and all these programs sort of developed independently, and they were like silos in the organization, and there was no coordination between them. So if training wanted to do a training program and quality work life wanted to do a training program and somebody else wanted to do a training program, they were all fighting for the same manpower. That was the same time that Louis Schultz was the bargaining chair at in Detroit for General Motors and the UAW. And Louis and I had talked about the fact that we could really use some coordination among our different joint activities so that we can manage them better. And Louis asked me to write a proposal, so I wrote a proposal on how we could manage this process through a person that we'd call a joint activities coordinator. And I submitted that to Louis, and Louis took that to the bargaining table and actually got a position in the contract called Document 46, and that's where the joint activities reps came from. So I was actually the first Document 46 in General Motors. At the time, I think we only had 13 full-time people who were doing those positions. They were only at the largest GM plants. During the next contract, they actually expanded Doc 46 to include all programs, and they allowed plant to have a Document 46 person for every 250 people, the same way that they did for the district committee. So there was as many full-time international appointees within the plant as there were district committee persons in the plant. So my first full-time position was the joint activities representative, which I held up until just recently when I switched over to quality network representative.
So did you enjoy that job?
Oh, I loved it. It was kind of interesting, though, because I did not like mornings, and we were on day shift at the time. I was on day shift at the time when we were doing these things, and I had a hard time getting in here at 6:30 in the morning. And I started forcing these coordination meetings and telling everybody we're going to coordinate these activities and these things are going to, everybody's going to know what everybody else is doing. And so I forced all the different heads of these different groups to actually meet with me on a daily basis. So they said, well, do we get to pick the time? And I said, yeah. So, okay, 6:30 in the morning. And they knew they had me there. So I had to come in at 6:30 in the morning to hold these meetings. So eventually I started having less and less of these meetings because I did not like 6:30 in the morning. But, you know, eventually we needed less and less meetings because we actually did a good job of starting to coordinate the activities. Everybody knew what everybody else's responsibilities were. They knew what they needed to do. They knew where we needed to allocate resources, where we needed to allocate monies. And we did have monies at that time because they had started what they called the nickel fund, where 10 cents of every hour, 10 cents for every hour worked in the corporation went to the National Center for Human Resources. And the National Center for Human Resources would send back 5 cents of that amount of money to local plants to do all these different various joint programs like health and safety and employee assistance and training and everything else. So we had a pool of money and we had some people and we had a whole bunch of things that we had to manage. And one of my first activities with the joint activities position was actually develop a process called Attachment C, which also came out in that contract. And that was joint goal setting by the corporation and the UAW, which I thought was a fantastic concept because it really got the two parties to sit down and instead of talking about their differences, to start talking about what it was that they had in common and what they wanted to achieve as an organization. And I think great things happened as a consequence of that attachment. See, even though that process sort of died with the next contract, the concept of management and union setting mutual goals and trying to achieve those goals did not stop. And in fact, that has actually improved year by year and contract by contract.
Did you attend your union meetings?
For 21 years, I had a perfect attendance record. Prior to me becoming a district committee person, I did not ever attend a union meeting. But when I was elected, I thought that was one of my responsibilities, and I did that. And I can say for 21 years, I never missed a meeting. I would schedule vacations at a different time. If some event came up that meant I missed a union meeting, I would not go. I mean, I almost became vain about my record of attendance at union meetings. But I spread that word among other people, too, because I would tell people, you know, when I was bragging about my attendance record that, you know, at one time I let other people make decisions about my life in that shop. And that's what happens at a union meeting. At a union meeting, you set the priorities and policies for the UAW. And why would I let somebody else do that for me? You know, I think I want to set my own direction for where I want to go and what I want to do, and that's my opportunity to do it, and I'm not going to ever miss that opportunity. So I have made a point to try to make every single union meeting. And like I said, I've become a little more lax in the last few years, but I have probably missed about 6 or 7 meetings in the last 25 years where I've attended union meetings.
When you became the JAR, or the Joint Activities Representative, were you afforded an office, or?
Did I have an office?
Yes.
Yes, I did. And in fact, at one point, I had a wonderful administrative assistant named Sharon McQuaid. So, most appointed positions had offices, and the offices were usually in conjunction with their salary counterparts. So, if you saw quality work life, there all the quality work life people would be in the same location, and they'd all have their own separate offices.
What kind of atmosphere was in the offices?
I guess I'm not understanding what kind of question you're asking. Where are you from?
Did the management and the hourly, did they get along well? Were there a lot of struggles throughout this whole process?
Well, there was a lot of change in the concept of what jointness meant. When I first went on joint programs, if you had a position, you had to have a salary counterpart. Or if a salary person was there, they had to have a union counterpart. And jointness was measured in numbers. You know, every position had to have a counterpart for that position because, you know, there was equality with the numbers. As time went on, the management workforce had a big push to try to drive out numbers of managers. And what you started seeing was more and more of the managers in these positions going away. Currently, I think the only department that has equality in numbers is probably health and safety. In fact, at one point in time, John Rosendahl was the salary counterpart for training, for quality network, for the newsletter, for joint activities, and probably a couple of other things. I mean, they had one salary person and they had a half a dozen hourly people doing those positions. Maybe even 10 or 12 hourly positions for one manager. The concept of jointness no longer meant numbers, it meant mutual goals, mutual ideas that we were trying to reach. And in fact, there are probably some activities that are totally union driven today that were at one time had to have half and half. But the equality or the jointness is no longer in the numbers or the resources. The quality the jointness is in you know, the fact that everybody has mutual goals that they're trying to reach.
So how long were you in that position?
Of joint activities rep?
Yes.
I was in that position until this year.
This year?
So from 1984 until 2006, was that 22 years, I guess.
You've been really involved in a lot of things going on in the plant. Could you maybe tell us if you've seen any kind of discrimination against women, different races? Touch on the atmosphere in the plant like that?
Yeah, I'll tell you a specific example of somebody that I know, Nadine Reynolds, who is currently one of our employees' assistance representatives. When I was working in the paint booth, they brought Nadine in to do a job, and Nadine is probably about 5 foot even, and that job was hanging up hoses on hooks, and I could barely reach the hooks where you had to hang hoses up on, and I'm 5'10". And there's just no way that she could do that job. And I kind of saw that. In fact, Nadine is a black woman, and I think that a lot of times, especially with shorter women, because there was some kind of a mentality in the shop that short women couldn't adapt to the job in the shop. And I saw a lot of that where they tried to drive these women or put these women in positions where they actually tried to drive them out of the organization. And they tried to do that with Nadine, I think, and talked about, well, they're going to disqualify her, and she wasn't fit for industrial work. And Nadine was such a likable person that she made friends real quick, and when that kind of talk started happening, the workers sort of rose up and said, you know, this is ridiculous. You've deliberately put her in a job she couldn't do. You need to give her another job, give her another chance. And they ended up doing that. They ended up putting her on a job in the sealer line, which was just ideal for somebody of her stature, of her height. So, but you'd see a lot of that kind of discrimination. I think there was discrimination against women because the shop at one time was a male-dominated environment. You saw a lot of resistance to the changes that women demanded. As an example, when I was the district committee person, there was a young lady that was offended by some of the posters of half-naked women that were, aligned on the desk and on the wet deck, and brought it to my attention. And I talked to the supervisor and said, "You need to take all those down." And why should we do that for one woman? You know, why is she running our business? You know, you tell her to keep her nose out of our area. And basically I had to explain the law to him and explain to him that they were going to come down one way or another, and either through his cooperation or, with him kicking and dragging, because it was going to change. But, a lot of the mentality that we had in the shop had to change because, we were adapting to an environment where all employees were considered to be equal employees.
You've seen a lot of changes. What do you think was one of the biggest changes within the organization?
Well, I think as employees started having more, like I initially talked about, that, the employees were told to sit down and shut up and weren't allowed to contribute. I think the ability to contribute to the organization has been the most significant change. It took a long time to get people to realize that your greatest asset in your workforce was your workers who do their job every day. I mean, there was a mentality that supervisors knew what was best for the corporation, or that skilled tradesmen knew how to fix something because they were skilled and had technical knowledge. And the fact is that we were underutilizing the people that we had in our organization. And through activities like quality work life and some problem-solving activities and quality network initiatives and a lot of the other initiatives that we've instituted recently, people are having more and more say in the business. And I think that's absolutely essential. In fact, the new facility is pushing for total employee empowerment, where employees will actually run their work groups and set goals and business plans for their work group activities. And I think that's where we need to go if we want to be successful and compete with people in foreign countries.
What about the suggestion plan? This is Jerry Smith. Is that going to be outdated then, once that we get into the new plant, that the suggestion plan is no longer going to exist?
Well, they still have the suggestions plan. In fact, they're populating it right now with people in the new facility, and they're going to have the same suggestion program they had over at Lansing Car Assembly and Fisher Body. It'll just probably be more team-driven than it was in the past. In the past, it was more what could individuals come up with to help improve the organization. But as they're driving changes, they'll be able to submit those in suggestions and get suggestions for it. They've also instituted, in addition to suggestions, a reward and recognition program, and they've had that in various forms also in the different facilities that we've had, or the different name changes that we've had. But there's spot rewards that they're allowing people to have, both as individuals and teams, for significant contributions. And all of those that have been done so far have been given to hourly people for their initiatives in managing the business. So I think it shows that change that we're actually working towards as an organization.
Lansing is known as the capital of quality. Why do you think it's called that?
Well, at one time, it was called that for a very specific reason, because they used to use a Q index, and it was a quality index, and they had a numbers rating from 0 to 150, and Lansing consistently had 145s in the quality index. If you look at that quality index to today, it's kind of a joke, because there are 100 more things that are looked at in terms of quality statistics today than what they were when that initially happened. And for quite a period of time, actually our quality slipped in terms of our foreign competition. We were still probably in the top 10 or so within General Motors, but you know, we weren't on a par with where our foreign competition was. And I think that's been, with our history and the fact that we were called the capital of quality, that we really want to be the capital of quality, it probably helped drive people to build a better quality product than they would have otherwise. Because once you have a reputation, you want to maintain that reputation, and our employees worked hard to make sure that we could keep that reputation up.
As we're sitting here today, they're tearing down Fisher Body. Could you tell us how you feel about that? What your thoughts are?
Well, I live really close to here, so I have an opportunity to probably drive by here every day, and it's kind of disheartening. And I said I was a first generation, but my wife's father worked in this factory also, so I kind of, we sit and talk about this every once in a while, the fact that it gives you a little pain in your heart to see them tear down a place that you spent most of your life in. I spent most of my adult life in this facility, and you hate to see it go, but at the same time, we're really making way for change. I mean, we've got a new facility. If we didn't have that, I'd really be heartbroken, but you know, we're trying to move on to something that's newer and better, and I think we have an opportunity to, even though we're tearing down a building, we're not tearing down the heritage. I mean, our mission statement at Lansing Delta Township is building on our history, and we carry our history with us to our new facility. Our history is not in a building. A building is just metal and block and bricks and steel and all those type of things. You know, the history of that organization really goes with its people. And I think our people are carrying a lot of that positive history with them into the new facility.
David, I really appreciate you spending your morning with us. I want to thank you for this opportunity, and I also would like to ask you if there's anything that you'd like to share with us that we've not asked you about.
Well, I could share tons of things with you, so. I guess from a personal standpoint, a lot of what I have learned in the organization, a lot of what the knowledge that I've gained, the interactions that I've had, I've been able to carry outside of the organization as well as inside of the organization. And I think there are a lot of other people in our organization the same way. Fisher Body and now over in Lansing Delta Township has caused us to become leaders in our facilities, and as a consequence of that, I think leaders in our communities. I see a lot of folks that do things now that they would have never done 20 years ago. School board members, elected officials, people who are the coaches of teams, the people who are head of their Boy Scouts organizations, and they're taking on a lot more leadership positions probably than they were before, because, you know, when we're teaching classes now at LTD, one of the first things that we hear from people is, I don't like standing up talking in front of people. Well, when people get used to standing up and talking in front of groups of people, they start assimilating new relationships in their community. They start doing things that they never did before. They start taking new steps. So I think we're building leadership in our organization. I think that's probably the most significant thing that we can do.
Well, thank you, David, very much.
Thanks, Dave.
We've enjoyed your interview very much. And I do have one question for the end of this. Now that you're going to retire, what will you be doing then?
I actually am working on my master's degree in public administration, and I'd like to get a job as a city administrator, county administrator, local government somewhere in a small community, and do that for a few years until I really retire.
Are you planning on it in, like, Lansing Township, or...?
Oh, I'm going to go wherever the job is, so I'm going to start applying for jobs elsewhere, around the state, and maybe even outside the state. Okay. Really not, don't need to be in one place. I've kind of moved around, so I'm used to going wherever I need to go to get the job done.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, David.